to the world beyond. Where the garden friends keep calling me back when I belong. We're setting sail to ride the night on the ship of dreams. Sail ship glides into the night with a solitary guiding light, like the magical evening star, leading me onward sleep. Once again has cleared my eyes and opened the way once more to a world of unrepentant lies and dark foreboding skies. We're setting sail to ride the night on the ship.
Lewis Tillett there, and that track was called Ship of Dreams.
$3.
Okay, Lewis joins me now once again to talk about his musical and life journey. The last two so-called solo albums we've discussed have been Ego Tripping at the Gates of Hell, released in 1987, and A Cast of Aspersions, released in 1990. When we say solo, of course, there was a band, but the albums come under the banner of Lewis Tillett. Hello again, Lewis, and welcome back.
Thank you so much, Arun. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's good to see you again. Just going back to that statement I made, you might just like to remind the listeners, as you mentioned last week, why the albums are referred to as solo when there was a band in tow. Why was it important to go under the banner of Lewis Tillett?
Yeah, it was, I'd played in a band for many, many years beforehand, a band called Wet Taxis, and that band lasted a number of years, went through many changes, but I always felt, and it was, it's just a fact of life, that if a band performs, it develops a sound, and then it's restricted to that sound. If people, now if you go to a Rolling Stones concert, you don't want to hear Keith Richards just playing acoustic guitar live. You expect that the Rolling Stones show. If you play in a band, people expect that. So you can refine that sound, but you're also defined by that sound. And so they were called solo albums because I was able to bring in lots of different players who suited the songs and the mood that I was trying to create. And it also created a lot, avoided creating internal conflict of people feeling that they're obliged in any way other than to just enjoy themselves in a form of musical expression, for each one being a one-off exercise.
Right, okay. Well, I think that everyone understands now the track that we're pursuing here. So we move on now to Letters to a Dream, released in 1992. But just before we do, you also said last week that you spent a lot of time of that time performing in Europe, and that the European audiences were much more receptive to your music. How so?
How so? There was an incredible dichotomy, and it still is to this day, between Europe and Australia. In Europe, I was very much associated with the early days of garage rock and guitar thrash bands that were rife in the right through the 80s, and I actually in some ways went overseas to Europe on the back of that. There was the Australian indie garage sound was quite a big event worldwide, and yet my songs were all based on piano, so I arrived there with a completely different sound. So it gave me an introduction, but then also gave me a new audience, and people in Europe. It's the music environment, the thing that created the Australian pub music scene of the 80s was just that: pubs, people going out, going down to the pub, getting plastered, a band playing a racket in the corner, and in music, quite the opposite. Often there was not even such a thing as a bar. People would turn up 15 minutes before the performance, sit down quietly, listen to the music, and then leave afterwards. So they were interested very much in the music.
Yes.
And as I found, the more intense, the more intimate, the more profound, the more emotional. A lot of Australian garage music was loud, ranting and raving, and good fun and all that sort of thing. But there was no really sincere depth of expression of emotion, I found. And in fact, it was maybe left over, it's not that long ago, and well, still very much is in Australia, considered a somewhat of a no-no to talk about very personal and emotional aspects of one's life, yet it's highly regarded in Europe and considered a great virtue.
Right, okay. Now, so you also performed in New York. Did you actually spend a lot of time there? Did you live there, or?
Yeah, I've mostly travelled through New York, a little bit of time in Los Angeles, but this album that we're talking about, Letters to a Dream, it's quite interesting. Again, getting back to the solo thing, the other key person involved was a fellow called Barry Wolofson, who was the engineer. Now, he had never recorded anything like this. He did not know what he was dealing with, meaning me, when I came in there. Is this guy insane? Is he a genius? Is he just having me on? Examples like a lot of the sounds. You've got to remember, once again, I think we talked about it being in analog days and everything hand-mixed.
Yes.
Well, a lot of the sounds that I used on this, because it was very much a piano-based album, is that I got an old upright piano in there, which I systematically demolished, and to get these tremendous sounds, and the sounds were like pounding the back of the sounding board with a sledgehammer, dragging a hacksaw bow across the strings, winding the strings up with a tuning hammer till they burst as many tons of pressure on a piano strings on the metal frame, then cutting them with bulk cutters. And of course, these can only be done once. And I remember actually leaving the studio. It was the proverbial midnight night shift, the cheap rates, and the next band was coming in the morning, and there I was, sort of carrying my so-called gear out, and all they were bolt cutters, hacksaws, sledgehammers, and the remains of this piano. I said, don't worry about me. I'm just a piano player. But Barry Wolofson had since moved on to New York, where I think he records, he engineers with a power station, I believe it is, a huge commercial studio doing the likes of Madonna and Robert Plant, the, you know, the multi-million dollar budget things, and still very fondly remembers this as his most interesting and rewarding recording experience. So I've developed a lot of friends actually all around the world.
Yes.
And New York, there's no end of small bars to play in. And
yeah, so I was going to say, and as you've touched on there with that recording, you were going through incredible turmoil personally, and you were diagnosed, or perhaps misdiagnosed, as you mentioned last week, with alcoholism when the realization of a rapid and dramatic decline in your mental health surfaced.
Yes.
Yes. So
yes. The misdiagnosis of alcoholism certainly ticked all the boxes for it, but by being treated for alcoholism meant I was not being treated for what the true demons were, and I was doing my best to be compliant with an inappropriate treatment, and during the a significant part of the recording of this, I was actually locked up in Roselle Psychiatric Hospital down in Sydney, and the record never would have got made if it wasn't for the champion of a wonderful woman who, her name is Mari Sloman, a psychologist there, who went above the authority of the doctors and the bureaucracy, who said, felt that it was unsafe for me to leave the hospital. She said, no, if he doesn't go into the recording studio and express himself, that he's really suffering, he's being tormented by something very deep that none of us know what it is. He doesn't know what it is, but this is a way of him safely expressing it. And through her generous and persistent efforts, they allowed me to go out and continue recording. And so the mental illness was really making manifest, which we could go right back to our first conversation of did you have a happy childhood. One pretends that they are when it's happening and says, well, it must be happy, until with a little hindsight one says no it wasn't. They're dreadful demons that are still unresolved and unknown to me. But music is I think I also talked about a dream of racing through a house and then being mute when I was trying to explain about the
yes,
demons.
Yes.
Music gave me a voice and led us to a dream. In fact, the title about it was that my dreams were so vivid it was very difficult often to differentiate between daytime, nighttime, whether I was asleep, awake, and I felt that I interacted so intensely with the dream characters. In fact, more than I did with people in the waking so-called real world, because my drinking was very much isolationist. I was not in no way a party animal. I would crawl back into my flat and drink to stop the voices. But when I would wake up, the dream characters are obviously no longer there. But many of the characters I'd want to stay in touch with. And I'd say, well, how does one stay in touch with a dream character? In the real world, if you meet someone, go away from them, you stay in touch, you write them a letter. You stay in touch by writing letters. Well, one can't physically write a letter to a dream-like character, but through the medium of music, one, in fact, can. So these are actually letters to these dream manifestations.
Because there are, I mean, you know, everyone has dreams, and you have a good dream sometimes, and you wake up and you desperately want to get back to sleep to continue the
yes.
story, don't you? Or get, as you say, get in touch,
yeah.
get in touch with that person. I know it's happened to me many, many times. Yeah.
Yes, and sometimes I'm happy, sometimes I'm sad, and all this sounds very. I don't know. It has been traumatic, and unashamedly say that in the most dreadful way, but not without hope.
Yes.
There is always, I don't know how, why, where it comes from, but I have this deep sense of hope, and through all of the music, often I try and paint a very, very dark, gloomy picture, but then a bright shaft of brilliant, colourful light that pierces it, and that light is so intense that it just is so stark and beautiful that it gives value to the dreadful darkness.
Right. Now, just I'm just a little some so some of letters. Letters to a Dream. Some of the recordings were made in New York, and some here. Is that right?
No. The engineer later went to New York. It was all done in Australia. It was done by myself and Barry Wolofson, and a few people came and went. Again, looking cross-eyed at me, you know, what are we doing here? Like, again, Jack Jezowski, the bass player, I asked him to play bass to one particular track, and all I had recorded was this destruction and demolition of a piano. And he looked at me sort of cross-eyed and said, well, what would you like me to play? And I said, well, just listen to it, Jackie. Can't you hear the groove in there? And just, I said it so convincingly, he just said, well, there must be one. So he played one.
Yes. Oh, goodness me. Well, I could ask you a whole lot of questions mm-hmm. about the piano, but we won't get off the track too far. Well, I can't help myself now. So what was the piano? Was it a wonderful piano to begin with?
No. Okay. It was a piano from an old nursing home that had acquired a new one. So I was able to give them a couple of $100 to take. It was on its last legs.
To take your frustrations out.
Yeah.
Okay. Right. Now, last week, when we spoke, you made a statement or a comment that the music industry is rotten from top to bottom, and that's just the good points.
Yes. it's good seriously. For something to be so categorically, yes. You know. I mean, might as well stick to you, be consistent
yeah,
about it.
But yeah, but seriously, do you think the actions of the industry contributed to your health, state of health as well?
Yes. I could again return to the idea of them being solo records. All of these, no one ever supported me. No one ever suggested to me to make a record. No one ever said, "We are a label. We would like you to make a record." I just decided to make records, and it's. Just, I'm not sure how much, sort of foul language I could use on the program, so I'll leave it to the imagination. But I think it's, safe enough to say that when I presented this record to the record label, the company owner said, "This is the biggest crock of shit I've ever heard in my life." And I've since had many emails from around the world saying it is their favourite record of all time. Not Lewis's record, but of all time. And it's a record that I'm very proud of. I believe that is, in the truest sense, unique. There is no other record in the world that sounds like it. And talking about Europe, most of the people who enjoy and listen to this are from non-English-speaking countries, yet they understand exactly where the music is coming from and the sentiments.
It's funny you should bring up coarse language, because there's actually a question I wanted to ask you, which we haven't discussed, but there's a lot of albums out these days, and there's certainly a growing trend to use coarse language. And so, we're always getting albums in here warning coarse language, yada, yada, yada. And I was going to ask you if, because none of the albums that we've had here in the library of yours I've come across, yeah, where there's been any coarse language at all. So I was wondering what your thoughts were on that subject.
I've never found it. I found that coarse language is just too simplistic to use in the songs. It suddenly puts a bang, well, there, that's what it is. I like my songs to be a little more ambiguous and a little more, and also I don't like to pontificate, and coarse language is often saying, "I say this and I'm too lazy to really reveal myself. My favourite use of coarse language is in humour. So many movies where it's just going along in a casual conversation, and yeah, I mean things like South Park and stuff like that, and that it, you know, it just has me rolling in stitches. I mean, I love the use of coarse language and humour at the right time, but for my music, I find it cheap and simplistic. And,
yes. Yeah. Well, I mean, from my point of view, you know, you are a true gentleman from what I've experienced and seen of you and chatted to you, and so that's why the question was going through my head, yeah.
Well, again, when you make that observation, that's when it can be really humorous, because you can build a persona in a conversation and then just to drop something really off can be very funny and can be quite disarming and in some ways endearing.
Yes. Well, you know, I mean, I don't use, and I'm really not talking about casually dropping the F word, but you know, I will tell a joke sometimes where it's, you know, where it's quite relevant.
Yeah.
And yes, I love seeing the look on people's faces when they're not expecting it.
I suppose like any comedy, it's timing. Just to drop a beauty in there.
Yeah.
What is the most inappropriate time, but actually sums it up. It's actually a great way of revealing someone's hypocrisy.
Yes.
Be really politely agreeing with someone and blah blah, and you just lay one on them, and it stops them in the tracks when they realise that what they've been talking is just
right.
Crap. You know.
All right. Well, I've digressed a little bit, but that's nice. It's all about getting to know you, Lewis. Now, Letters of the to a Dream, that came out that was released in 1992.
Yeah.
So that would have made you, I think, about 33?
I was born in 59, so 33, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So when did you start, when did you start making the album? How long was it in progress?
The way all of these albums have been made is I do not sit down and write songs for something to do. Every album has been self-financed and through a lot of in-kind favours by generous musicians who have helped out, I've always lived on the, well, financially below the poverty line, but thanks to the wonderful institution of APRA, there's a forced savings plan, and particularly playing over years, royalties will take often a number of years to come through.
Yeah.
And suddenly I'll have a chunk of money, $4,000, $5,000, $6,000, $8,000. And then as soon as I get that, no, I don't go out and you know, say, treat myself to, you know, something nice. So I immediately say, I have to make another record, and that's what I do. It was almost a commitment from the very first album that I made, is that, you know, I was loaned that money and was actually given that money by my father, who's now deceased, and I've just reinvested the return from each album in making another one.
Right. No, I'm just... Sorry, I've got my paperwork out here because we've just about run out of time again, and what I'm looking for quickly here is to find out the next album that we'll be discussing, The Ugly Truth. Would that be right?
That's right, yes.
1993. Okay. All right, now the first track we played from that album, Ship of Dreams, did you want to say anything just about that briefly?
It's fairly close to the beginning of the album. And it even more follows this continuing analogies and between the sea, dreams, journeys out to sea, journeys into the mind, that the sea is a long-standing theme through and more albums that we'll talk about later.
Yes, I've noticed that.
And this next song that we're about to hear is called the the Tempest. And
yes.
It's funny because I don't want to be too long-winded, but making a joke before about the Flaming Lips with Ego Tripping at the Gates of Hell, well, yep. I thought, well, if Beethoven wrote a Tempest and Shakespeare wrote the Tempest, well, I'll have a go at writing the Tempest. But this is just a dream. It's a storm at sea.
Yes. Oh, there's so much to discuss, Lewis.
there is. Yeah. And in fact, there's so much to discuss. I've got a German publisher in Nuremberg who for over 15 years now has been asking me to write a book, and I just don't know where to start.
Yes.
I just don't know where to start.
No. All right. Well, it's time to say goodbye, unfortunately, so we will go out with The Tempest, Lewis Tillett from Letters to a Dream. From 1992, and this was, you'd say, probably the darkest.
The darkest, and if anyone was to see the album cover, which is actually I think all the album covers are on the website, is that it was taken by a photographer her name is Kirsten Wieg, who's a very stylized photographer in Bonn in Germany, and she asked. What would you like to look like on this photo? Well, wasn't it necessarily meant to be an album cover? And because Bonn being the birthplace of Beethoven, I said Beethoven 10 years after he was dug out of the grave, and I think she succeeded remarkably. And again, when talking about industry support or lack of, that they said you cannot put a photo like that on the cover. That is the most unflattering photo, and yet people all around the world say that it is a work of.
Was that the one with the? Because we don't have the album.
Orange one with the glasses.
With the glasses, and, yeah. It was decidedly ugly. There's no doubt about that.
Yes, a great photo.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks again, and you'll be here next week.
I certainly shall.
Okay.
Sky.